Afternoon, I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Health and Social Services Committee to order. Time is 1:31, April 1st, 2013. With me today, I'm joined by Senator Kelly, Senator Ellis, and myself, Stedman. We've got one bill on the agenda today and one presentation. Senate Bill 87, Newborn Screening for Heart Defects. Presentation by the Department of Health and Social Services regarding the information technology and telehealth. And we're going to start with Senator Machiki regarding newborn screening and for heart defects, and we'll have a brief at ease. This is the first hearing on this bill. The intent today is to have the sponsor introduce the bill, take questions from the committee, and accept public testimony. I don't intend to move the bill today, as this is the first hearing. At 2:15, we'll set this bill aside and move on to the presentation on telehealth in case it runs a little long, and then we're going to adjourn promptly at 3 o'clock and keep on schedule. Senator Machiki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is about Senate Bill 87, an act requiring screening of newborns for congenital heart defects and providing for an effective date. I have a particular interest in this bill. A couple examples, but I'll tell you about the latest. My niece, which her name happens to be Nisi, which is, she was born in Japan 4 months ago. She was fortunate enough to be tested for congenital heart disease, where they test automatically. She has a problem. It ends up being treatable, but were it not for the testing, might not be telling you about Nisi at all. So an estimated 1 in 100 children are born with a congenital heart defect. Kills more children in their first year of life than any other birth defect. The U.S. is moving toward adopting the same testing procedures as is done in Japan and other countries, and just doing some research online, roughly. Many states are moving in this direction as well. In Alaska, many hospitals aren't waiting for our encouragement from Juno, and some of those hospitals that are adopting procedures are already conducting the tests are Providence, Alaska Regional, Alaska Native Medical Center, Matsu Regional, Bassett Army, Fairbanks, Central Peninsula Hospital. Screening itself is very simple, utilizes the pulse oximetry equipment most hospitals and clinics already have regularly on adult and child age patients. Had a video that we may bring to the next meeting if we have time, kind of shows the test, but finger clip, it's painless, it's non-invasive, it can be done by a trained nurse right at bedside, which is typically how it's done. It helps detect more than 75% of critical heart defects with a sensitivity rate of over 99% and a false positive rating of less than 0.03%. And it can also detect other life-threatening conditions such as pneumonia. The cost of the test is under $10, and it's covered by health insurance, it should be covered by Medicaid patients as well, I believe it is. The cost of early detection treatment is much lower than the cost of late diagnosed treatment and the cost of caring for a disabled child later. This bill will require larger hospitals beginning in January 2014 to test newborns with pulse oximetry. Birthing centers and hospitals with fewer than 50 beds will have until January of 16 in the event they require additional time to acquire the equipment. Of course, it's our hope that facilities will begin testing long before they're required. Parents, I know this is important for parent rights, they will have the option of opting out of the test if they so choose. In the event of abnormal results, the healthcare provider will have the responsibility of just simply informing the parents of some of the options to have follow-up treatment for the child. Additionally, the bill provides a mechanism for hospitals to report newborn pulse oximetry screening results to the public health community. You'll see the fiscal note. The reason I'd like to hold the bill to at least Wednesday is we're still going through this with the department. Actually, all we want the department to do is keep the data that yes, the test was administered, and yes or no, that there was a negative result. That's the only data we're looking for. We believe that the fiscal note will be much lower. We can derive our own data on those that decide not to have their child tested. So far, we've had no opposition on this legislation. We've reached out to Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association, Alaska Nurses Association, Alaska State Medical Association, Alaska Primary Care Association, Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, and the insurance industry. My intention with this legislation is to save as many babies as possible and hopefully provide for a system to implement the testing process in a smooth manner that doesn't cause hardship for our state's medical facilities. If you see the long date, this isn't a hammer. This is a gentle tool to help encourage the testing of infants. And we're still working on getting some information, like I said, from the department, which is why I'd like to hold this until at least Wednesday. With that, we have some folks that are going to testify for us here today, Mr. Chair, and I'll just leave that open to you to call them at will.
Do any of the members have any initial questions for the bill sponsor? And there's one fiscal note in your packet from the Department of Health and Social Services in the amount of $384,800, in which $346,300 is general funds and $38,500 is federal receipts. There is nobody signed up online to testify. Well, they've signed up to answer questions. But is there any testifiers online? Okay, we're going to go to the off-net and start with Becky Miller. If you can introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, and speak to the bill, please.
Becky, my name is Becky Miller, and I am a mother of a child who was born with a congenital heart defect.
Okay, you want to testify to the bill?
I do. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to share why I believe that congenital heart defect screening and pulse ox testing is vital for Alaskan babies. My daughter was born with a critical congenital heart defect known as hypoplastic left heart syndrome. Life-saving interventions and open heart surgery performed out of state were required to save her life. Over 50% of Alaskan babies with congenital heart defects will go undiagnosed. These babies are at great risk of severe complications and even death. We do not have pediatric cardiac surgeons in Alaska, so every minute and every second following the birth of a baby with a congenital heart defect is critical. Families who take these undiagnosed babies home end up in the emergency room with a critical baby. Some may even die. A simple non-invasive test can be done to prevent that very dangerous and scary scenario from ever occurring. It's basically a sticker on their toe, and it can save their life. Another point that I'd like to make is many Alaskans are on Denali KidCare, and it would save the state a lot of money paying for this screening rather than paying for an emergency airlift out of state. Please support this bill that will undeniably save lives. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Your testimony today. Next up, Dr. James Christensen.
Yes, my name is James Christensen. I'm a pediatric cardiologist in Anchorage, Alaska, and I also support this legislation. I'm passionate about this. Congenital heart disease is the most common birth defect. About 8 per 1,000 infants will have some form of congenital heart disease. This is actually more common than all the metabolic diseases that the state is currently screening for, so that this is a major health problem. Unfortunately, the current methods of detection of heart disease are prenatal screening, such as an OB ultrasound or a physical examination. Unfortunately, both of these methods detect less than 50% of infants who have congenital heart disease. Pulse oximetry screening, which you're considering today, is a very simple, non-invasive, painless test that is used to measure the level of oxygen in the blood and can help diagnose critical congenital heart disease before an infant gets sick. And that's the whole purpose of screening, to detect infants who are not ill at the time but could become ill before serious problems would result. Critical congenital heart disease is a definition is heart disease that will require surgery within 1 month of diagnosis. Alaska has roughly about 12,000 live births per year, and so about 100 children per year would have congenital heart disease, and of those, about 40 would have critical congenital heart disease. And 20 of those would be missed with the current methods of detection, either physical examination or prenatal screening. So I believe that pulse oximetry screening would be a very cost-effective and very helpful method of helping our newborns in Alaska.
Okay, does that conclude your testimony, Dr. Christensen?
Yes, it does. Okay. I entertain any questions if someone had them.
Okay. Seeing no questions, thank you for your testimony. Next up, Anna Marie Cernan, if you can introduce yourself for the record and who you represent and speak to the bill, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. My name is Anna Marie Cernan, and I'm speaking today on behalf of the Newborn Coalition, an organization that leverages health IT and medical technology to improve outcomes and reduce disparities for babies. I'm the co-founder of that organization, which happened sometime after my daughter, Eve, was diagnosed at 2 days old with congenital heart disease. I had a rather uneventful pregnancy with 3 prenatal ultrasounds. I was kind of in a somewhat urban area, so some of those ultrasounds were actually level 2 ultrasounds, which are quite detailed examination of the heart, and her heart disease was still missed. She looked perfectly healthy at 2 days old, yet was in profound heart failure. Her heart was about 3 times the size it should have been at the point at which we were detected, which was when our bags were packed and ready to go out the door. But after she survived 2 heart surgeries, I embarked on a mission to help advance this screening of the most common and deadly birth defects, resulting in the federal recommendation, thankfully, and many states now adopting this important screening. I don't have to restate any of the wonderful points that Ms. Miller and Dr. Christensen have stated. All of them were right on the money. It's cost-effective and painless and non-invasive and absolutely the right thing to do. So coming from another state that has a lot of rural hospitals and rural deliveries, I just want to sort of restate the importance of this screening, particularly for those babies in rural and underserved communities. They are the ones that are most likely to be undetected prenatally and most likely to be missed after birth. And so for states like yours and states like mine, it's incredibly important to have this extra screening tool to get them the care that they need so they're not coming back and being diagnosed in the emergency room, or worse, in the morgue. I appreciate your time and interest in this topic. I can take any questions if you need.
And thank you for your testimony. Next up, Dr. Lily Liu.
Thank you, Senator Sidman and committee. My name is Dr. Lily Liu, and I'm speaking for myself in support of this legislation. I am the medical director of the Newborn Intensive Care Unit at the Children's Hospital at Providence. And I'm also the vice president of the Alaska chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics and the district 8 representative to the executive committee of the National AAP section on perinatal pediatrics. I believe that there's now very strong evidence for this practice as a standard of care for all newborns. Legislating evidence-based practice is not necessarily the only or the best way to assure up-to-date medical practice by physicians, but I would support any way of accomplishing the goal of screening for this serious and almost always treatable condition for babies born in our state. It makes a real difference in outcomes to diagnose this problem right away before babies sustain significant damage. If we do pursue the legislative route, there are 2 important points to consider. The first is that pulse oximetry is the current gold standard. And if new technologies develop, the legislation must accommodate a way to update practice to the improved technique. And secondly, the bill as written does not address the important issue of babies born at home. If this is the right thing to do for babies, then it should include all infants born in Alaska. That is what I have to say, and I'll answer any questions if necessary.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Liu. So Seeing no questions, that concludes the off-net testimony. Is there anybody in the room that would like to come forward and speak to this bill that was too shy to sign up? You can come forward, please. You can introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, and speak to the bill, please.
Sure. Good afternoon, Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Jenna App, and I'm testifying today on behalf of the American Heart Association. Senate Bill 87 would ensure that all newborns in Alaska are screened for critical congenital heart disease, CCHD, using a low-cost, non-invasive screening tool called the pulse oximetry, which we've heard about, prior to discharge from a hospital. CCHD defects are the most common birth defects and are the leading cause of death in infants with birth defects. Critical congenital heart disease are those critical heart diseases which, if not treated, can cause severe complications and death. Pulse oximetry measures the amount of oxygen in the baby's blood as well as the pulse rate. It is quick, the costs are minimal, and has been proven to be effective. Even though healthcare professionals do a really good job of diagnosing these diseases, some are not as easily identified and they can be missed. And the simple test of pulse oximetry screening can catch those misses and save the lives of those babies. If consistently administered, pulse oximetry screening for CCHD will save the lives of babies in Alaska. It is widely supported across the country and also in our state, as you've heard this afternoon. The American Heart Association urges your yes vote on SB 87. And thank you for your time.
Okay, thank you for coming in today. Seeing no other people wanting to come forward, that'll conclude our public hearing portion of this bill. Do we have any questions for initially for the sponsor? Okay. We'll go ahead and set this bill aside for further review. Next up on the agenda. Telehealth presentation. Here to provide the presentation on telehealth is Paul Cartland, the State Health Information Technology Coordinator, along with Stuart Ferguson, the Chief Information Officer with the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, and they said they're going to give us a lively presentation and keep us wide awake in the middle of the afternoon after lunch. If you guys can introduce yourself for the record and take us through your presentation, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and committee members. For the record, my name is Paul Cartland. I am the State Health Information Technology Coordinator for the Department of Health and Social Services. As you mentioned, with me today is Stuart Ferguson. Stuart is the Chief Information Officer for Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today. We hope to find our presentation informative. We'll work on lively. Please stop us at any time during the presentation if you have any questions, and I'll turn it over to Stuart to begin.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Stuart Ferguson. I'm the Chief Information Officer at the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. I'm also the President of the American Telemedicine Association and a 7-year board member of the ATA. I thought, given the interest in the cost of health care, I'd focus really today talking about the impact of telehealth on helping to reduce or change the cost of health care delivery in Alaska. And we have some evidence from a project that's been running in Alaska since the 1990s, and that's called the AFCAN telehealth program. AFCAN is an acronym. It stands for the Alaska Federal Healthcare Access Network. It's an acronym from the 90s. It's really not just in Alaska. It's not just federal, and it's really not just a network. But I'll be talking today about some of the financial impacts of AFCAN. In Alaska, this program has been running, like I said, since the 1990s. We've been delivering health care through the system since 2001. And I went back and looked at data for the last 10 years, from calendar year 2003 to calendar year 2012. In that time, the Alaska Native Medical Center in Anchorage received almost 23,000 cases coming from villages and regional hospitals throughout Alaska. Now, these are store and forward cases, meaning that somebody captured data, maybe an image, some heart and lung sounds, some pressure waveforms of the ear, and sent them to the Alaska Native Medical Center for consultation. Now, of those 22,597 consultations that were billed to insurance providers, 11,000 of those encounters were for Medicaid patients. Of the 13,000 patients that were seen, about half of those, so a little over 6,000, were Medicaid-eligible patients. During the 10 years, the Alaska Native Medical Center received just a little over $600,000 in payments from Medicaid, which translates out to about $60 per those 11,000 encounters. So not a lot of money for providing health care in Alaska. What's interesting, though, is the impact when you look at those numbers on patient travel. A lot of telehealth programs throughout the United States and in fact, in the rest of the world will typically assume a telehealth encounter prevents patient travel 100% of the time. We don't make that assumption. We have asked the providers every time they do a case, did it impact patient travel? Did it cause travel, prevent travel, or have no impact? And we have thousands, tens of thousands of responses to that question. And what we have found is that about 75% of the time, specialty encounters that come to the Alaska Native Medical Center prevent patient travel. So we make the assumption that only 75% of our cases prevent patient travel. The other 25% are going to travel regardless. We always assume that travel is prevented to the nearest hub, be it Bethel, Kotzebue, Barrow. We don't always assume that people are flying into Anchorage for care. But we do know a small portion would fly into Anchorage regardless, and that's about 25% of those patients. So I guess the point is this is a fairly pessimistic study. We're not assuming 100%. We're not assuming they all fly to Anchorage. If you live in Bethel, you don't fly any place, and we don't save travel costs. And we also assume that if we saw four cases for a patient in 1 week, we'd only have prevented one trip. They wouldn't have flown in four times, even though we got four different telehealth encounters. So when you put those numbers together and you start to figure out the ages of the patients and if they had a guardian and where they lived, and we use some of the DOD per diem rates and some of the other things in this study, what we find is that on an annual basis, we are now saving about a little over $1.5 million in patient travel for those cases that come to the Alaska Native Medical Center for those specialty consults. In 2012, we estimate we saved about $1.6 million just for those consultations, and cumulatively we'll save about $8.5 million since 2003. Now keep in mind, that's $8.5 million in patient travel saved for an investment of about $600,000 in the professional fees paid to physicians. Well, we actually do a lot more telemedicine in Alaska than that what comes to the Alaska Native Medical Center. We have a lot of telemedicine. In fact, about 75% of our telemedicine originates at a village clinic and goes to a regional facility. In fact, we've done 114,000 of those encounters in the last 10 years. Now, I don't have the statistics on how many of those were Medicaid patients. My data on the Alaska Native Medical Center comes from our billing system, but we estimate about half of those patients, at least half of those, would have been Medicaid eligible. We do know from the providers that about 20% of the time we prevent travel to a regional facility, and a small percentage of those would have traveled on to Anchorage. But making some of the same assumptions about age and location of those patients, you actually find that just for the primary care side of taking care of our Medicaid patients, we're saving close to $2.5 million on an annual basis. So when you roll these two numbers together for primary care and specialty care, our estimate for the Medicaid population in Alaska is that in 2012 we saved about $3.9 million in travel. And cumulatively over the last 10 years, that's about $18.5 million. When we extrapolate, and we're taking a little bit of a jump here, and we don't just talk about Medicaid patients, but we talk about all of the patients involved in telehealth in Alaska, and about 16% of the Alaska Native population is involved in any given year. We estimate that right now we're saving about $8.3 million in patient travel costs for a total of about $38 million since 2003. Now, I want to point out in these graphs, these are annual savings. These are not cumulative. So the 8.3 was really in 2012 alone. So in terms of a return of an investment, I mentioned earlier that the state has spent about a little over $600,000 paying the Alaska Native Medical Center for taking care of Medicaid patients with telehealth and probably saved millions of dollars. It turns out that we estimate that Medicaid saves about between $10 and $11, about $10.50 in travel for every dollar spent on professional fees for telehealth consultation. So that's a good return on investment. The other thing that we get with telehealth, or one of the other things, is the ability to make diagnosis and treatment plans for patients in a much more rapid manner. And we track how long it takes us to provide consultations in Anchorage for patients that live far outside of Anchorage. And this plot's a little hard to understand, but if you look at the 2012 line, what you find is that about 30% of the time in 2012, we're able to provide a diagnosis or a consultation or a treatment plan within 60 minutes of getting that case from a village or a regional hospital. There's no way we can provide that level of care by waiting for the patient to fly. And about 60% of the time, we can do it within the same day. Now, that's a level of care that we can't get in a major urban center anywhere in the United States. You can't get a specialty consult in 60 minutes, but we can do it through telehealth technology. So just to give you a few of the highlights, and I think this is an important concept for what we see happening in Alaska, that the Alaska Native Medical Center provided close to 8,000 specialty consultations in 2012, and that's up from about 4,500 the year before. We're seeing about 50% growth in the usage of our system to receive specialty consults in Anchorage. We're not seeing such a huge rise, but we're seeing about a 25% growth in primary care cases throughout the state. So the bottom line is we're using the system more and more, and it has not plateaued. It shows no signs of flattening out at this point. We're also doing a lot more with it, and what I'm not including in my numbers are some of the other things we do, such as doing discharge follow-up cases. So when we actually discharge patients and want to do post-surgical follow-up through imaging, we've done 20,000 more cases last year, up from 4,000 the year before. So we're using this system to just basically to communicate out to our regions. And this is a thing that we're doing with telehealth because it's available, but it's something I fully expect when we've health information exchange running throughout the state. It will supersede this and vastly grow well beyond what we're using telehealth for. We have about 1,500 providers that use the system throughout the state of Alaska, and we served about 20,000 unique patients, which is 15% of the Alaska Native population. Now, I don't know if those numbers seem high or low, but if you talk to all the telehealth programs, you talk to the folks in Ontario where they've got a provincial healthcare system, the Ontario Telehealth Network, you find that about 2 to 3% of their patients are involved in telehealth. And that's considered one of the largest networks in the world. So 15% is huge by any stretch of the imagination. So I tried to keep this short. I kind of wanted to focus on two things. One is that there are significant cost savings in Alaska through the use of telehealth. And the other one is that we can use this to provide care in a much more rapid manner to patients in the villages and the rural areas. I just want to give you a sense of where this is all headed. Everything I've talked about today is through what we call store and forward, where we capture data and send it. We struggle doing this over live video conferencing because we have so many different systems, and it's a challenge to make sure they can work on any given day. But we are now investing in a video conferencing technology that can be used throughout at least all the Alaska tribal health partners and perhaps throughout the entire state. It's very easy, it's seamless, and it's kind of similar to what you've seen with Skype, where it works and you know it's on. We're building this out with a 24/7 support model, and that lets us start to think about doing ED visits, trauma care, stroke care, all the things that we've been a little bit worried about doing because we did not have 24/7 support for video. So the world will change, I think, in the next 12 months from the video conferencing perspective. We're looking at different models for remote patient monitoring, tracking patients when they return to their homes to try to stop them being readmitted into the hospital. And there are many studies out there that show that this can reduce the cost of care for those patients by upwards of 50 or 60% by just managing those patients and providing constant monitoring. And the last thing I'd like to finish with is that I work in a hospital, and I work with over 200 sites throughout the state. They're all adopting electronic health records. They're all trying to meet what's called meaningful use. They'll all be adopting ICD-10, which is a completely different method of coding for billing purposes. There's a lot of changes going on. But what I like about in Alaska is that we all are working very, very close. We've built out a telehealth system. I work with Paul, and I work with the state and the Alaska eHealth Network at trying to connect our EHRs and our telehealth system to the health information exchange. The Alaska Tribal Health System has made a decision to rely on the patient portal technology offered through the health information exchange as our patient portal for our patients. So I see a world in the next few years where telehealth will grow, HIE will be adopted, portals will be available, and I really think this is all dramatically going to change the landscape and improve care for our patient population in remote and rural areas. And with that, I thank you very much for the opportunity.
Yeah, before we jump to the next presenter, maybe you can give the committee kind of a brief feel for bottlenecks that you faced on bandwidth restrictions. Seems to be an issue that pops up from time to time.
There is a lot of bandwidth, a lot more bandwidth than there was a few, say, 6-8 years ago. I think we'll always need more bandwidth in the state of Alaska. We have a funding mechanism through the federal government to subsidize that bandwidth, and as long as the telecommunication carriers can keep up with it, I don't see that being our biggest challenge. Where I see the challenges being, if we start to do more live video, is it's going to be a scheduling nightmare. We're going to have patients that will want to see providers that may not be within their own hospital now. They can be anywhere in the state. We have pediatric specialists throughout the state we'd love to share, and they would like to share their specialty care. How we schedule those resources and make them available on a statewide basis will be, I think, the next big challenge we face.
Senator Kinchy. Mr. Ferguson, can you go back to slide 4? I'm just trying to understand. If you can sort of walk us that
one.
I'm sorry. Two slides toward the end.
Past that one.
Past there. That slide. I'm sorry. Yeah. There you go.
Okay.
So today, how is most of this working? If you can pick someone from one of the most remote reference points. Are they video conferencing today, or can you tell me someone has an ailment at the most remote location here? How are they being served?
Through the chair. Sorry. The way it works today, there's a blend of things. So there is telehealth, and then there's in-person visits. If you are a patient in a remote village and you need to see a provider, you typically go to the clinic, and then if you need to see a specialist, there would be two alternative paths. One is that you would literally fly all the way down into Anchorage, or you would wait until a field clinic where a specialist would fly out from Anchorage to that site and would see everybody that was on a waiting list. Field clinics happen roughly every 3 months in some of those sites, so the waiting time can be significant for those patients. If it's urgent, it would just fly straight in. With telehealth, the way that works is, of course, to capture the data. It's typically sent to a regional physician who then, if he needs a specialist, sends it on to Anchorage, and then the response happens fairly rapidly.
Okay. Senator Ellis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could you go into just a little bit more detail about the interplay between telemedicine and implementation of electronic health records and the requirements of the Affordable Care Act? The interplay between those things.
Through the chair, Senator Ellis. Boy, that's a pretty complicated question. So I'll take it kind of a couple steps on the way. So we had a telehealth system that's been running for a long time. People are using it. Now that people have electronic health records, physicians don't want to live in two different systems.
Right.
So now there are several ways to solve that problem. Immediately, the challenge is to make sure that you're not creating new patients, that they're integrated at that level, that the same patients show up in telehealth as well as the EHR. That problem was solved. That's integrated. The next step is for the physicians, they only want to live visually in one system, and that's typically the electronic health record. So we are now moving to integrate the telehealth application so it looks and lives right inside the electronic health record, so it looks really like one system. The next step, of course, is to really have this a fully integrated system where the data moves between the systems. Because right now, telehealth is the only thing moving data from one organization to the other, and the needs are way beyond that. And that's where the health information exchange is honestly, it's the only and it's the real solution to that, because that allows the electronic health records to push data into a central location where you can see it. But the beauty of what's being built, at least in Alaska, is it also supports a messaging technology. And that, I believe, is what's going to be very powerful in the next year or two, because the electronic health records have their own internal messaging to talk. Well, the HIE can provide that EHR to EHR. And so our doctors can now start to communicate, push data, share information. And I think that's where I see all of this going at some point. I hope that answers your question.
Yes, that was very helpful. Please go ahead with the next presentation, please.
You want to pull it up there? Oh. If you can. Sorry. I think I know how to do this.
For the record, I'm Paul Hartland, State Health Information Technology Coordinator for the Department of Health and Social Services. I'm here today to provide an overview of the rest of the technology that matches with and enhances the ability of telehealth to help control costs, improve quality, and deal with the fact that we have limited resources, human as well as dollars. Next slide. And the next slide, please.
Okay.
Just going to cover a few things. We'll talk about benefits. We'll talk about what we're doing today, what we are planning to do over the next few years, what federal support programs exist, some challenges, and some next steps. Next slide. So, talking about benefits, use of video conferencing and electronic sharing of data to ensure that the provider has the information that they need to provide the best care at the point of care, where preferably where that patient lives. So we can help to improve the lower the cost of care, because as Stuart mentioned, we're reducing travel, improving the quality of care because the doctor or physician's assistant or nurse practitioner has the information that they need to be able to provide the most effective care. That's what this is all about. Those are the benefits. Next slide, please. This slide gives you kind of a pictorial representation of how it all fits together. As Stuart was mentioning, the provider wants to work in a single system. They don't want to have some of their information on paper, some of it in electronic health records, some of it on a telehealth cart or wherever. They want to work in a single system so that they can have all of the information that they need readily to hand. So we're working on integrating the telehealth and the electronic health record, working on integrating the electronic health record with the health information exchange, which then connects to public health and to the pharmacies, to the laboratories that are reporting on the lab results, with the long-term care facilities so that we can handle transitions of care. And then ultimately, we want that health information available to the patient, because the patient's the one who cares the most, at least I hope, about their own health. And so that's how this all fits together. It's not simple, but it's been proven to reduce cost and improve quality. A couple of examples of where we're using telehealth, and we're hoping to improve on it through this process, is, for instance, API is planning on providing remote behavioral health services around the clock at various centers so that the bedside team has access to the psychologist or psychiatrist who can help them provide better care. Next slide. This table gives you some of the current uses of telehealth, some of our planned uses for telehealth. Healthcare services is actively, as Stuart indicated, paying claims for use of telehealth in clinical consultation. The Office of Office of Children's Services is using video conferencing to provide behavioral health and clinical consultation for assessments and case planning. The Division of Behavioral Health is using or is planning to have a pilot for using for delivery of behavioral health consultation over mobile devices using the same technology that Stuart was talking about that's very much Skype-like. Alaska Psychiatric Institute is using the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium Network to provide behavioral health consults today. They want to expand that in the future. The Division of Juvenile Justice is using telehealth, using video conferencing for behavioral health consultation, assessments, and case planning, as well as visitations. Senior Disability Services is planning on using video conferencing to support assessments and case planning. And then Public Health is planning also to do consultations using telehealth as well. Particularly, there's a pilot running with the Veterans Administration in Southeast, looking at Juneau, Gustavus, Kaufman Cove, Nakati, Tanaki Springs, and Elfin Cove in order to increase access to care. Thank you. This slide is a pictorial representation of the Alaska Psychiatric Institute network that where they've connected to Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium and others in order to be able to provide those behavioral health services. So we've talked about some of the why. In order for this all to work, we have to have electronic health records. In order to exchange health information electronically, you have to have that information in some electronic form in the first place. Next slide, please. So recognizing the value and potential efficiencies that can be gained, Congress established the Electronic Health Record Incentive Program as part of the American Reinvestment and Recovery Act. To qualify for payments in that program, providers and hospitals have to adopt and meaningfully use those electronic health records. They have to be certified electronic health records. So meaningful use is, I won't say a term of art, but it's a somewhat nebulous term. There's a lot of information in the handouts on what meaningful use is, but the important thing is for you to understand is that the meaningful use criteria, one, involve reporting quality measures on an annual basis, and the requirements increase over time. So just because you're a meaningful user in 2012 doesn't mean you're a meaningful user in 2013 or 2014. The requirements ratchet up over time. Electronic health record incentives are only available to a certain portion of the providers and hospitals, and not every provider is eligible. Some of the ones that aren't, most behavioral health providers, long-term care providers, most physicians assistant in the state are not eligible. Next slide, please. As Stuart was mentioning earlier, one of the issues is cost. The medical incentives or the EHR incentives, electronic health record incentives for hospitals start out at $2 million total. Those dollars are adjusted based on the number of or percentage of Medicaid encounters and other factors like length of stay. That amount is paid out over a three-year period. For an eligible provider, the amount is $63,500 over 5 years. But as a to kind of make sense of that, for a hospital, a 500-bed hospital, the cost of the EHR, just the cost to buy the EHR, somewhere between $10 and $70 million, depending on what you bought. That's just the beginning of the cost. That's not the cost to implement. It's not the cost in additional staff to support. It's not the cost of lost productivity, because it takes the doctors and nurses time to become efficient at the use of those electronic health records. So there are significant costs. Stuart was sharing with me earlier, at least in his sense, it was probably twice the cost of purchase when all is said and done. For eligible providers, the cost is $15,000 to $70,000 per provider, and that's, again, just to buy the electronic health record. One of the requirements of meaningful use is that you have to exchange health information with an unaffiliated provider. So we can't both be in the same office and pass a note back and forth. That doesn't count. So that brings us to the topic of health information exchange. And there are really two approaches to health information exchange, to electronic health information exchange. One is PUSH, which is very similar to what doctors do today or providers do today, where you give me a piece of paper and I take it to the next provider that you referred me to, or my staff faxes it to the next provider's office. This is just a more efficient method. We take it electronically, we send it securely electronically to the receiving doctor. The second type is pull or query-based exchange. That's where I show up at the provider that I've been referred to. The provider goes out to the health information exchange and says, tell me everything you know about Paul Cartland, and it comes back with relevant data about me, my allergies, what medications I'm on, what conditions I have, those things necessary to provide treatment to me. Our original grant from the Office of the National Coordinator for Health Information Technology authorized us to pilot query-based exchange, pull exchange, and to implement push-based exchange. We've been piloting the query-based exchange since early 2012 in the Fairbanks area. We began push-based exchange in the fall of last year. We have, at this point, over 4,000 push accounts. It's essentially secure email, where a provider can send electronic health data to another provider via a secure email connection. The query-based exchange, we finally received approval to go into production from the Office of the National Coordinator on the 28th of February, and we anticipate that will go into production in the Fairbanks area in later this spring, and then we will begin adding additional hospitals and providers, with one of the first being Alaska Native Medical Center. Next slide, please. So next steps, we need to conduct those pilots that I referred to earlier, the behavioral health, mobile telehealth, video conferencing with the Office of Children's Services, and with Adult Protective Services for investigation and case management, and the veteran telehealth pilot. We want to establish the personal health record. One of the requirements of meaningful use is that you engage your patients. And so you have to have a patient portal so that your patients can access their personal health record, their data. We need to integrate more health records into the health information exchange. We want to do that in the most cost-effective manner. For some, that will be an interface via push. Some, it will be full-fledged interface for query-based exchange. We need to implement patient-mediated exchange via this thing called the blue button. For veterans, it came out of the Veterans Administration. As a veteran, I can go on to the My Healthy Vet website, and I can log in, and I can download my personal health information that has been created by the VA. I can only download theirs today. By June, they anticipate that I will be able to go in and not only download that information myself, but I can tell the VA I would like to have that information sent to Dr. Ferguson or to the Alaska Health Information Exchange or any destination that I would choose. We want to implement chronic disease management, which is reminders for both providers and patients about actions that they ought to be taking to deal with whatever conditions they have. And then we also are integrating with to do syndromic surveillance, which is will allow for early detection of outbreaks using the Center for Disease Control's BioSense 2 platform. So one of the last things to talk about, there are gaps, there are challenges. We do have limited bandwidth and infrastructure, particularly in the remote communities. It is getting better. There have been a number of efforts to increase bandwidth, but as Stuart indicated, we're not there yet. We will probably always need more. Although use is growing, it's not growing fast enough. The costs to purchase the EHRs, particularly if you're not eligible for an incentive, is a barrier. There's a lag time between systems development and implementation and establishment of appropriate policies around use of those things. And it's a moving target. The requirements for meaningful use are changing rapidly. The market of electronic health records that are available is changing rapidly. New ones are coming into play. Some companies are dying. The biggest one is probably the one that Stuart mentioned. There is no service that matches me as a patient with a provider who has time and the capability to provide telehealth for me. So if I'm in Bethel and I need some sort of specialist, I have to rely on somebody here knowing somebody there who can contact the doctor to say, do you have time? When do you have time? Can we schedule an appointment? And then we have to have people on both ends to facilitate. So that's probably the biggest challenge. Next slide. So what can we do? Continue to support telehealth. We need to create or develop a provider directory, one that says, here are all the doctors or all the care providers. Here's their specialties. Here's what their capabilities are in terms of telehealth. And then what their availability is for scheduling appointments. We need to work on the inequities between medical telehealth and behavioral telehealth. We need to, as we said earlier, work on the connectivity and the bandwidth. And we need to support networking the various entities together using the health information exchange and other technologies as they come on the scene. That concludes my testimony. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today. I hope we've shown you some key ways that we are and hope to continue to improve access to affordable and quality care in rural Alaska.
Any questions for the chair?
Just one quick one.
Yes, Senator Machiko.
How does a facility with electronic health record capabilities communicate with a traditional health center for transferring the records back and forth?
Through the chair, today they fax, they print and send it along with the patient. With the health information exchange, there will be options. Certainly with the push technology, if I'm a doctor and I have an electronic health record, and Stuart is a doctor and he doesn't have an electronic health record, but he has an account that allows him to receive these direct push messages, I can email those to his direct account and he can print them, look at them on his screen, whatever he chooses.
Okay, any other questions? That concludes the meeting today. I'd like to thank both of you guys for coming forward today and giving us the presentation. Our next hearing is Wednesday, April 3rd. We're going to hear a presentation from the department regarding obesity prevention, and we'll also bring up Senate Bill 87 under bills previously heard. We are adjourned.